Hi, I'm Rachel. I am with Texas Children's Hospital Immunization Project. Good thing I'm wearing heels because this is like just barely my height. I'm with Texas Children's Hospital Immunization Project. I've been there for almost 4 years, and I'm going to talk to you about the book that hopefully you've received a copy of. I think some of my coworkers were handing copies out, and there's some by the door, and we have some available at the information desk for you to take. But the book is called Vaccine Preventable Disease, The Forgotten Story. And I just want to talk to you about how book sharing can impact vaccine decision making is seeing believing. So I just want to say I have no relevant disclosures or financial conflicts of interest. And I really hope today to describe how medical professionals are using this book in conversations with parents, as well as describing how sharing the book impacts parental immunization decisions and to identify additional immunization education needs. So just to give a little bit of background, the book, we originally published the first version in March of 2009. And we originally set out to do the book because we felt like in this whole vaccine debate that's been going on, that there was a really important message being lost. And that message was that of the families, that vaccine-preventable diseases are dangerous and that they tremendously affect the children and families that experience them. And so we wanted to tell this other side of the story, this emotional side that parents just weren't capturing. They were capturing the emotional side of the autism story, but they were not capturing what can really happen if you contract a vaccine-preventable disease. So over about a year and a half, we collected photographs, and I conducted interviews of families who'd been affected by these diseases. And we covered everything from flu to measles to meningitis. And we put them together in this book, and we published it. So it was actually 2 years ago at the Dallas NIC that we first released it. So shortly after the first version was released, we realized that it had its shortcomings, mainly H1N1. It was right after that the H1N1 pandemic hit, and the book did not address pandemic flu. And so we took the opportunity to address that shortcoming, and we released an updated version just last October. The updated version has two H1N1 stories. We also added in another HIV meningitis and meningococcal meningitis story, as well as a new pneumococcal meningitis story. And interestingly, that pneumococcal meningitis story was based on a family who was vaccine concerned. They had decided to delay all their child's immunizations until the age of two, and then their son contracted a vaccine-preventable disease, and they became very pro-vaccine. So that is one of the new stories. So the new version has 20 stories versus the previous one has 17. And to date, as of last week, we have distributed close to 108,000 books. That includes 90,000 approximately of the original, close to 9,700 of the new one, 7,700 of a Spanish version that I'll discuss a little bit later, and 9,800 of posters that we've made as well. So the first part I want to talk to you about is just the survey and who participated. We did a purposive sampling among previous recipients and purchasers of the book. So it was, I sent the survey to people who have either received a complimentary copy or had purchased, who we had an email address for, and also who were a physician or school nurse. So we sent it to 266 people. It's a pretty small survey, but we wanted to focus on how healthcare providers were using it. And we had a lot of bulk orders, and so we wanted to really focus on those clinicians who were ordering just like a handful. We used SurveyMonkey, and we had a 35% response rate. And like I said, it was physicians and school nurses. So and each participant received a gift set of two of the updated version, two of the Spanish version, and a set of posters for, as a thank you for participating. Of our respondents, we had 62% were physicians in a community medical practice. So they were either in like a private practice, a group practice, but they were working in the community. And then we had 29% that were school nurses, primarily elementary school. And then the remaining 9% were just kind of a mix of physicians and nurses, either in a hospital setting, an academic institution, a not-for-profit, or public health. So the first question we asked them was, where do you distribute this book? And just so you know, all of these, the next few responses, they were able to respond more than once. And so they used it in multiple contexts. They distributed it in multiple contexts. And so that's why these percentages are not going to add up to 100. But so 72% said they distributed it in the waiting room or exam room. 26% said other, which I'll discuss in the next slide. 16% distributed in schools, 4% in immunization conferences, 3% in educational class. So where is this other? A lot of our respondents said they give it directly to parents. We also found that people were giving it at junior league events, to their clinical faculty, at prenatal consults, to the PTA at their school, daycare providers, birthing classes, parenting classes, and health fairs. The next question we asked was, how are you distributing it? We really wanted to know specifically where they were placing it, how they were using it, and again, these respondents were using it in multiple contexts. So 65% said they use it pretty passively. They leave it in the waiting room or exam room. They leave it for the parent to review, and then they hopefully the parent will initiate a conversation or if it provokes questions, but that was 65%. 60% also use it as a conversation tool. So they will use it as to jumpstart a conversation with a vaccine-concerned parent, and they typically use it in conjunction with other information. So, and then 42% also give it directly to parents. And when I say give to parents, I'm talking specifically give to vaccine-concerned parents, and they're giving it to them to keep. This isn't sitting in your exam room. This is actually handing it to them, letting them take it home and absorb it. 11% use it to educate medical professionals, and 7% use it to advocate for immunizations. So it really, we really found that it has multiple parallel uses. They're using it just kind of all over their practice to educate about immunizations. 76% of respondents reported using the book in direct conversation with parents. 95% of respondents reported having had a parent change their mind about immunizations as a result of reading Vaccine Preventable Disease, The Forgotten Story. I was really surprised by that. I think what that led us to question was, obviously it seems to be effective at persuading parents about immunizations, but what is it exactly that's going on in these conversations that is leading parents to change their minds? So that's the next part of the survey. We identified 5 parent types. The first type was an advocate. That's like you or me. We tell others about the importance of immunizations. The second type was an acceptor. These parents typically follow the recommended schedule. They don't have very many questions. These are not your vaccine-concerned parents. The third type are ambivalent parents. These are probably the majority of parents. They occasionally question the importance of immunizations. They'll ask a moderate number of questions, and really they're going to need reassurance to immunize. The fourth type was a delayer. These actively immunize outside of the AAP recommended immunization schedule windows, but eventually they are fully immunized. These parents actively select, they delay, they are on their own. These are the Dr. Bob followers. These are the delayers. And then we have the refusers. They actively refuse one or more immunizations at any given time, and they are never fully immunized. So we asked our respondents to report how frequently they are sharing the book with each parent type. As you can see, several of them are highlighted in red. 49% of respondents said that they occasionally use it with ambivalent parents. 37% said they occasionally use it with delayers. 34% very frequently use it with delayers. And then refusers is really the primary audience. We have 37% always use it, 26% very frequently use it, and 25% occasionally use it. And obviously advocates is occasionally used kind of across the board, but really we're not targeting advocates, we're not really targeting acceptors. The target audience, delayers, refusers, and ambivalent. And I think that when it comes to those ambivalent parents, we might call them fence-sitters. I think the book might be that little bit of information that the parent needs to feel comfortable immunizing, and it might be just what they need to hear so that they realize really how important vaccines are. The next segment of the survey was, what type of immunization information are you sharing? So they all reported that they were using the book in conjunction with other information. So we know that they're not just handing them the book and leaving it at that to educate. When they're talking with their parents, they're using other information. 77% said they use written and verbal. 32% said they use verbal only. And 20% said they used other written material. The type of written information that they're using is primarily free handouts. So we're talking VISs, CHOP tear sheets that you can order for free. The second majority was web material, so material you can print off and copy, so sheets from the Immunization Action Coalition, from the CDC that answer vaccine concerns. And then following that, we have 15% use other vaccine book, and by that I mean do vaccines cause that, or what every parent should know about vaccines. And then we had 14% that used purchase handouts, so like CHOP has those reference materials that you can purchase, and then 3% said they did not use written information. The type of verbal information was really interesting. It seemed that the respondents were using a variety of written information and a variety of verbal. So they all kind of responded that they were using all three types of verbal information. We had 86% said that they were using their professional experience. And by that I mean their professional experience with a patient who had a vaccine-preventable disease. 71% said that they were describing the written material, so explaining side effects, answering questions about the handouts that they're giving these parents. And then 55% said that they were also using personal experience, that experience as a parent, a grandparent, or a community member. So they're using all of their experience, all of the goods, to try to talk to these parents about immunizations. So what did this show us? What did we really learn from these questions? Well, we learned that the book is really great for refusers and delayers. It seems to be really effective at increasing the perceived severity of vaccine-preventable diseases. It seems to be really great at increasing their perceived susceptibility to vaccine-preventable diseases. And again, it's most commonly used for those vaccine-concerned parents. So it might be that we're raising the awareness of the danger of vaccine-preventable diseases. They're realizing that the danger, the perceived threat, is not just in the vaccines, but it's in the not getting the vaccines. We also asked them what stories seem to resonate more with your parents. And we heard over and over again, flu, pertussis, and surprisingly, HPV, that these stories really seem to be resonating with their parents. We asked what were the perceived barriers to parental immunization education, and I don't really think that these are any big surprise. The number one that we heard over and over again, probably from every respondent, was misinformation or lack of information, that these diseases, that parents just don't know about them. The second barrier was that we're victims of our own success, that we just have ignorance about childhood illnesses, and these parents just, we don't realize the consequences of vaccine-preventable diseases. The third perceived barrier was distrust, which was distrust of both the government and physicians, sort of anti-establishment. And I think it's really almost becoming a cultural phenomenon that these parents are coming in order to feel like they're making an informed choice, that they are questioning the judgment of the physician and conventional medicine. The last one is ambivalence. And this is probably a pretty strong one, ambivalence in that they don't place urgency on the follow-up to immunization. So they don't fear the vaccines, but they also don't fear not getting them. And this is really a tough one to address because it's really just making them realize how severe these diseases are. So this is just some of the written feedback that we got when we asked the respondents, you know, what is it that you like, and how is it that this book suits your immunization education needs? And we had some really interesting responses. One person said that it allows parents to see themselves in possible scenarios that actually happen to real parents. Another one said that it's compelling. One said it's a helpful adjunct to provide to nursing employees to help them deal with parent refusals. Parents will say, how do you know? I may not personally know the heartache, but the individuals in the book do. And then another one said, is an excellent tool to convey to parents the tragic effects of vaccine-preventable illness on children and families, as well as the success story of vaccination. The last question we asked was, what other types of material would you like to see developed from these stories? 60% said online stories, which would be great to have these stories and more available online. 56% said one-page flyers, 36% said video, and 31% said more posters. So after all this, we kind of got to thinking, well, so what does this tell us? Well, It really tells us that the book that you're holding is really, it's not a standalone piece, that it is most effective when it's used in conjunction with other immunization information. And there really seem to be parallel uses, leaving it in an exam room and leaving it in your waiting room for a parent to peruse and to initiate the conversation with you. But it can also be used to jumpstart a conversation with a vaccine-concerned parent and give them that piece of anecdotal information. And many parents are also giving it to parents, or many providers are also giving it to parents who have vaccine concerns for them to keep, for them to take home and to kind of let it marinate. Although we realize that this might be cost prohibitive for some, it can be really effective as well. But it really seems overwhelmingly common for these providers to just be bombarding the parent with educational material. So we're giving them the clinical information. We're giving them the written information in the form of VISs and the handouts. We're giving them our personal experience and our personal knowledge. And then we're kind of closing it with this anecdotal information. And I think it's this combination that can be really persuasive. The second thing we learned is that free is the operative word. And I know that in today's economy that is really tough to provide materials for free. And these books certainly, excluding this conference, are not free. We charge $350 a copy. But really, to make them affordable is really important. So we charge $350, but that really is the cost of what it costs us to produce it. We don't make any profit off of that. And I think to make our materials affordable is really, really imperative. So we've had some previous feedback, which led to some additional material. As I said, we have a Spanish edition. It is an abbreviated version. There are some available on the information desk. It has 5 stories, and we really tried to target the Hispanic population. So we selected those stories which would be most effective at that population. So we chose pertussis, flu, H1N1, and meningitis, and HPV. And we published that abbreviated version. And we also have posters available in English and Spanish. And so for this study in particular, it led us to think about what we needed to develop. And I think what we've realized is that the supplemental one-page, one-pager with more clinical information is really important. So we're working on developing that because we think that having that clinical information and having it from the perspective of the parent could be really powerful. So, you know, I lost my kid to pertussis, and this is what I've learned about vaccines since my child died. That perspective, rather than it coming from the voice of possibly a clinician, I know that Allison Singer talked about that in her presentation, how important it is to talk to parents as other parents. So that is our next project, and we're working on developing that. So I just wanted to end with one of the new stories that we have in the book. And this is Billy Carey. His story is on page 29 of your book. But I wanted to share Billy's story because he really, to me, is the face of H1N1. And I know we're kind of all H1N1 out, but his story I chose him because it's just so powerful. There was so much controversy about the vaccine and about the disease. And, I mean, to this day, we hear people who just were like, it's not that big of a deal. I don't need the vaccine. It's scary. And his story really proves that it is scary. It is serious. The vaccine is safe. And it's really important that we get vaccinated. Billy was 13 years old when he contracted H1N1. He was a tennis player. He was in perfect health. His family was very pro-vaccine. His mom was a school nurse, and they'd actually already had their seasonal flu vaccine. But unfortunately, the H1N1 vaccine was not available yet. And as I said, when people talk about the H1N1 vaccine and how it wasn't safe, it just really irks me because after having met Billy and realizing how important that vaccine was, you know, to say that it's not safe or to say that H1N1 is not bad is just really, I guess to me, it's almost disrespectful to his experience. And so he was already immunized, but not against H1N1. And it began just like most cases. He just had flu-like symptoms. He had a fever, and then he deteriorated very quickly. He began vomiting. His fever increased. He began coughing. And eventually his parents, Kim and Bill Sr., took him to the local emergency room. where he went downhill very quickly. They took him to the Texas Children's Hospital emergency room, where I remember Kim and Bill telling me that they remember coming in from the ambulance and doctors and specialists just like swarming on him. They intubated him and just were trying to save his life because he just was dying. And they had to just wait helplessly by as they tried to save his life. And it just happened so quickly. So he was placed in a drug-induced coma in which he was kept for 23 days. He was in the hospital for 54 days. So he became sick on September 4th of 2009. He did not return to school until January 6th of 2010. And during those 54 days, this kid had every curveball thrown at him that you could possibly have. I'm just going to list the big things that he had. He had multiple brain bleeds, double pneumonia, MRSA, multi-organ failure, as in kidney failure, septic shock, pancreatitis, gallbladder, liver problems, heart failure. His lungs collapsed several times. He had DIC, ICU psychosis. He became addicted, obviously, to his pain medication. He was so badly infected that his toes and fingers became necrotic. He actually doesn't have all of his toes. This is kind of anecdotal. It's not in your book, but he... when I went to interview him, he had a little box, and he was like, "Do you want to see my toe box?" And I was like, "Do I?" Yeah, he's 13. He kept his toes. So I was, you know, which I kind of thought was cool. I don't know. But yeah, so he has a toe box where he kept what was left of his toes. No, he did not open the box. I drew the line there. No, but you know, I interviewed him a year ago, and he was still really suffering severely. I have talked to him since then. He, like I said, he was an excellent tennis player. I think just last summer he was able to start playing tennis again, but he did not recover all the lung function in his right lung. He had a persistent cough and fatigue. I think I interviewed him like February, March of last year, and I remember going to with the photographer, and we had to take breaks because the kid was so tired and was coughing, and it was just like this nagging cough. He said he hadn't gotten a complete night's sleep since it had happened because the cough kept him up. So Billy's story is just, it's an amazing story of survival, but it's also an amazing story of how important vaccines are. And I think it's also a powerful testament as to why it is that we do what we do.